Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is pensions and investment editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, is it time to unpick the triple lock? Plus, more and more savers are being caught out by putting too much away for their retirement. We look at the councils, who one charity says are failing families who can't afford a funeral for their loved ones. Plus, should we gazump the gazumpers? And we have a reader case of proper bank says no madness. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a deal is a deal. A promise is a promise. Except maybe when something unexpected, like a global pandemic, happens. The government now finds itself with rather a conundrum on its hands. To be fair, it has a few, but this one relates to the triple lock. It was introduced in 2010 with the honourable purpose of protecting pensions from inflation and making sure that they go up every year by a real tangible amount. So either the rate of inflation, average earnings, or 2.5%, whichever is higher. What was unforeseen in 2010 was a potential rise of 8%. When the country's finances aren't exactly in the rudest of health. Simon, you wrote about this, but firstly though, Tanya, just explain about the triple lock. What was the thinking behind it when it was first introduced? And has it, I don't know how you'd measure this, but has it been a success?
Well, it depends how you look at it. Yes, in some ways, as you said, it was an honourable attempt to make sure that pensioners got a decent increase in their state pension every year of at least 2.5%. So at least they had some certainty. It's also been a bit of a political gimmick, it's got to say. It's artificial, and the people who criticise it year after year and have suggested going to a double lock point out that this 2.5% is an anomaly. It isn't sustainable in the long run. It's going to get too expensive eventually. That's obviously different from the current situation. In terms of whether it's been successful or not, I mean, its popularity, I suppose, speaks for itself. It's been successful with the people who get it because they don't want to lose it and are up in arms at any slight suggestion that they might. In recent elections, all the main parties have felt they have to or have wanted to commit to keeping it, presumably because in the short term they want to win an election and elderly people vote.
So Simon, 8% rise, where has this come from? Potential 8% rise.
Okay, so what's going on here is this wouldn't necessarily be a problem if people's wages were actually going up by 8%. In that case, I think people would say, okay, fine. Well, we made this deal. David Cameron's government, Theresa May stuck by it. It was in the Conservative manifesto, a deal's a deal, and you stick to it. But what's actually happened here is that the statistics being used as one of the three measures of the triple lock, and actually it's an official statistic that is used to measure average earnings, are not possibly as sophisticated as one may think they could be, and also didn't allow for that black swan event that we had last year. So there's a comparison going on to a year ago. 3 months to X month compared to the same 3 months to X month a year ago, right? What happened a year ago is that millions of people ended up on furlough, so they had their wages cut by at least 20%, okay, and some by more. Depends how much you earned, okay. If you were a higher earner and you were furloughed, you lost out more because there was a cap on what you could get. Lots of lower paid people lost their jobs. They bore the absolute brunt of this. Think about the kind of the hospitality industries and things like that. And a sizable chunk of those people who kept their jobs took a pay cut, a temporary pay cut. A year on, some of those things are going into reverse. We've seen huge numbers of people taken off furlough, so their wages have gone up by a considerable amount. We have seen still lots of lower paid people bearing the brunt of this and out of the equation, so their wages have been taken out of the pot and the average has therefore gone up. And we've got the people who kept their jobs, kept their pay and had their pay cuts, have their pay cuts reversed. So the numbers are being skewed. And the OBR came out this week and warned that they might be skewed to the extent where it looks like people are getting an 8% average pay increase come the month that the reading is taken in. And they're not getting an 8% average pay increase. In fact, in the public sector, there's a pay freeze. The nurses who saw us through the pandemic are furious because they've got special dispensation to have a whole 1% added to their pay. And many of the people who work in the private sector and kept their jobs, kept their pay throughout all of this, experienced a pay freeze last year as well, and haven't seen their wages rise since 2019. Annual wage growth climbed to 5.6% in the 3 months of April, could hit 8%. It could actually go further. There are some people saying it could, depending on what happens, get back into double digits. Now, the question is it fair to give pensioners an 8% increase to their state pension that is based on figures that have been distorted by the pain that working people have suffered over the past year? Or is a deal and you stick by it? Now, this has been being talked about for some time by those in the pensions know. It is a problem, another problem, rumbling down the road for the government that already has plenty of problems to deal with. Up until now, it seemed to have been doing its best version of let's hope the problem goes away.
Yeah, I remember us talking about this ages ago.
Yeah, so last month, the Prime Minister's official spokesman said there is still significant uncertainty around the trajectory of average earnings and whether there will be a spike as has been forecasted. Our focus is to ensure fairness both for pensioners and taxpayers. So that if ever there was a, you see that can, I'm just going to kick it down the road answer. Yesterday, it was stoked up a bit because Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, did say, he sort of gave the first indication that they might need to err more towards fairness. Unfortunately, however, if you're a pensioner and you've been made this promise, and even if you're not a pensioner, some people think this, they think fairness, to them, fair is a deal's a deal. You promised us the highest number out of these three things, and if it comes in at 8%, we should get it. Now, one of the arguments being put, and just to give a reflection of that, we put a poll up on the website a while back. Yeah. We have so far had about 2,700 people vote in it. 90% say, yes, should the government honour the triple lock if it means a huge rise in the state pension? Yes. 10% pay no. I wrote my column about this yesterday after Tanya's been writing some great stuff about it in the last weeks. 933 comments on there. A lot of them going, yes, you should definitely give it to us. Now, one of the things that is mentioned in there repeatedly, and we were talking about this yesterday in the office, me and Tanya, is this thing about the reason why people are saying that they should get it is because Britain has one of the lowest pensions in Europe and in amongst developed countries. There's an OECD report that's put out regularly about pensions, and it uses something called pension replacement rates, and which shows how much of the average earnings get replaced by the pension. And it looks at state pensions around the world in the sort of developed countries. And the UK looks pretty bloody awful by these figures, okay? We have a replacement ratio, gross pension replacement rate of 21.7%. That's for men of pre-retirement earnings. Now, the OECD average is 49%. Just above that is Russia at 49.6%. So you can see why people complain. They're like, hang on a minute. I mean, the average is 49 and even Russia does better than that. We are the only country we're ahead of is South Africa. And some of the countries look amazing. Italy looks fabulous. You get 79.5%, for example. Portugal, Spain, Austria, Netherlands, France. These are all countries that get cited here. There is a problem with these figures and with this report. And this is something that we were talking about yesterday in the office, me and Tanya. And we're going to be doing a proper article digging into and trying to unearth what's actually going on here. And that is that this only takes into account the state pension. And in quite a few of these countries, work pensions and state pensions are sort of bundled into the same system. So ours looks really, really bad because some of the others are including the pensions that people have built up through their employment, whereas ours doesn't. Ours is just your state pension. And yes, obviously you pay into that through national insurance while you're employed and so on and so on, but it's not the same. We also pay money into company pensions in this country, that don't get included in these figures, whereas in other countries they are getting included in these figures, that sort of work element. And once you take that into account, we actually go up above the OECD average the last time we looked into this properly. And the other thing to mention is that the new state pension, the flat rate state pension that was brought in some years ago, has done quite a bit to sort of ameliorate this situation. But so when people say, yes, we should get the 8% because our pensions are so awful based on this report, they do need to be aware that this report is not an entirely accurate representation. It's not comparing apples with apples, basically, yeah, when you compare the UK with other countries. But who knows? I mean, I don't know what the answer to this is. I do think that there is a question of intergenerational fairness here. And is it right to give people a massive pension increase who've seen no cuts to their pension over the past year? Okay, they still got their pension every single week for the past year, based on the pain that has been suffered by people who are employed, who've had pay cuts, lost jobs, seen businesses destroyed, been furloughed and all these other things, because there's a distortion in the system. And it's not the government talking about ditching the triple lock, absolutely. They're just saying, well, maybe we'll just like smooth it, go for like 3 years average earnings or something, which would probably still mean a bumper pay rise. But it's a hot potato and there's a lot of people saying, no, give us the money.
Indeed. 90% on your website. Tanya, there's a quote from Stephen Cameron in Simon's article from Aegon, who says state pensions are paid for by national insurance contributions of today's workers. So granting state pensioners a rise considerably greater than those of working age might effectively mean that younger generations are subsidising those above state pension age. Okay. But isn't there an argument that if we bump this up now, it's not like the following year they're going to take it down, is it? So actually, eventually, all rises every year will benefit people who eventually retire, including younger people now.
Well, yes, that is true. I suppose that people are thinking in the next year or so, not in decades to come. Also, quite a lot of people believe that the state pension won't exist when they retire. I don't think that is the case, but that is something that comes up quite a lot. So that may be playing into it. The thing is, I believe that the government will come up with an acceptable political fudge at the end of the day, probably in September, but the latest by October, when the inflation leg of this comes out, because they can't let it run on and let people get attached to the idea that they might get 8% or whatever. They've got to start letting people down. And obviously, that's what Rishi Sunak was starting to do yesterday. I'm a supporter of the triple lock because I think that having at least 2.5% is a bit of certainty for elderly people. They're on a fixed income. They have paid into it all their lives. And yes, as you say, everyone is going to end up benefiting when they get old. However, it would be absolutely balmy to give people really massive increase just based on the fact that the figures have been distorted for 1 year. I do believe it will be a political calculation at the end of the day. If I think they can get away with anything up to 5%. Anything between 5 and 10% is going to look really iffy, as we've seen the idea of 8%, Rishi Sunak's already coming out. Anything over 10%, I just think will be absolutely impossible. You're talking it will be double digit at that point, and that will be in the headlines. That will just not play.
Why can't they just freeze it? They've frozen loads of other things during the budget, and one of those, or two of those, we're going to be talking about things like lifetime limits for pensions. What about freezing it in last year's increase? The same amount again. That wouldn't work.
But this is the thing, Georgie. People, there's a degree of anger here. You made us a promise, the deal is a deal. Okay, and bear in mind, it's not just pensioners saying that. There are people who are not pensioners saying that. I mean, I don't know what side of the fence I come down on this, but I do think that potentially delivering an 8% rise based on a distortion caused by other people's pain is probably the wrong thing to do in terms of intergenerational fairness. But even if they came up with a fudge that gave people 5% and the official number was 8%, people would still be angry. I mean, as a representative comment of the kind of stuff here, okay, from one of our readers, the government has spent over 100 billion supporting jobs, presumably substantially benefiting younger people. We should be spending the extra 3 billion on pensions as a one-off. We have the worst pensions in the OECD, and any increases are being wiped out by paying for TV licenses and 5% council tax increases. Now, the only thing I would say to, well, the things I would say to that is, those OECD numbers, as we just discussed, you can't totally trust those, because some countries are being artificially inflated by having their work pension system bundled in. Now, not everybody has a work pension, but those people in the countries who don't have the work pension probably won't be getting that either. Any increases are being wiped out by paying for TV licenses and 5% council tax increases. But younger people are paying those as well. You don't get to not pay your council tax or your TV license, you know, if you've had your wages cut or lost your job or been furloughed or things like that. Yeah, you might get universal credit, but actually it's quite difficult to get universal credit. And funnily enough, there's an argument about universal credit being cut at the moment as well. And the other thing I would say is it did spend £100 billion supporting jobs, which has substantially benefited younger people. But the reason why it did that, and I don't want to go any further into this, you know, is that we went into a lockdown in order to protect the elderly and the vulnerable in society, who are disproportionately the pension age people, whereas the younger people who suffered the financial pain of this have very little to fear from coronavirus. They don't get affected by it anywhere near as much. And, it, you know, there's a whole big argument about all of this stuff going on that's got nothing to do with economics and money and things like that. But there is, it does kind of cut both ways in the sense, in the fact that, yeah, there was an awful lot of money spent on furlough and supporting people's jobs. But a lot of that went to people who willingly, you know, sacrificed their kind of, you know, themselves into lockdown and everything in order to help out other people, kind of. There is a serious point there, like £3 billion compared to the amount of money that we've lobbed at the wall over the last year and a half is peanuts. So maybe we should just spend the £3 billion.
But look, my heart, my instinct, my whatever goes to, you know, pay pensioners as much as you can. Great. But it's like you say, all right, but let's base it on true figures if we're going to stick to the triple lock, something that's representative. And what do the OECD figures really show us? But very interesting article nonetheless, and a very difficult decision by the Chancellor. A quick straw poll though, Simon, yay or nay, triple lock, is it going to go ahead as is, i.e. with any potential 8% rise, or do you think something will happen?
No. I think they're going to do something about it. I think that the plan of hoping that the problem goes away has a percentage chance of working, but I don't think it necessarily will work. And I don't think that they're going to find it palatable to give pensioners an 8% pay rise, but maybe they will. Maybe it will look like good PR.
So that's a no from Simon. Tanya?
I think they'll come up with a political fix, and it will depend on what the what that figure actually depends on. I think though, and actually I believe this would be right, that they should keep the triple lock in the long term, and I think they will.
I agree. I think it will stay, but I think there might be a change for this year or for April 2022. All right. While the government may be keen to scrap the triple lock, whether they will or not, two things they doubtless want to keep are the annual and lifetime limits. In fact, they probably don't want to keep them as is. They might want to drop it a little bit. Increasing numbers of savers are being caught out by them as they stand. Tanya, firstly, though, a bit of pensions 101. What are the annual and lifetime limits? Not just how much they are, but what's the purpose?
It's the amount that you can put into a pension either every year or over your working life and still qualify for pension tax relief, which is the top up that the government puts into your pension. The annual one is 40,000 for most people, except for higher earners who have a slightly different and very complicated system. The lifetime allowance currently is just close to 1.1 million. That's been frozen now until 2026. That's what the Chancellor announced at the last budget, which means that more people will be drawn into it. However, the various kite-flying reports that we've had coming out from the government about what they might do to raise some money in the autumn statement suggest that they might actually cut it. That would start affecting significantly higher numbers. We are talking only 13,000 or so, I think, on the lifetime allowance, and 34,000 or so on in terms of these being landed with these charges. It is a small number, but on the other hand, it's a significant blow to people who have been saving hard and saving successfully for their entire lives.
Of course, and I suppose that doesn't include people who decided to sort of jump out early so they didn't get caught with the charges. Yeah?
Well, there's a big debate about what you should do. If it's the lifetime allowance, I really think that if you're getting to that level of pension, you really should see a financial advisor. Basically, financial advisors are more and more valuable to you the more and more money that you have. And if you've got that amount of money, I think you should see somebody. There are various things that you can do, and they will advise you about which is the best one for your circumstances, because it does depend. It may well be that carrying on paying into your pension is still a good idea, and weather the charge, because your employer is still making contributions. Some employers will make special arrangements for their highest earners. Obviously, their highest earners are usually the people running the place, so or have got a lot of power within the business, so they can come up with some kind of deal where they'll get some alternative to a pension arrangement. There are also various schemes you can put your money into, which involve investing in quite high risk companies as an alternative. But all of these things require a lot of thought before you do them. And I don't think it's wise to select any one of them blindly. You need professional help at that stage.
I mean, you said those figures there, they weren't that large of the number of people being caught out. But if the government does slash the limit to, I mean, I think I'm reading 800 to 900,000, maybe. Yeah. A lot more people are going to get caught in the net. It's not all about what you put in as well with sort of DC pensions. It's about investment growth as well. And this is what sort of got Ros Altman, the former pensions minister, talking about it, saying they make no sense in a DC world.
Well, yes. I mean, you could argue that. I mean, do you really want the government giving pension tax relief uncapped, though, to people? In a way, you could argue that you should have one or the other, but not both. But then you could say, well, for instance, the annual allowance, if you have that, then that will control how much people are putting in, and therefore you don't need the lifetime allowance. However, I heard quite an interesting report on a money podcast from the US, and they seem to have an uncapped system for the highest earners, and really seriously wealthy people can game it and end up getting the American equivalent of pension tax relief, however that works, on extraordinary amounts of money to the level that is completely insane. So you just don't know, do you? There's always quirks and loopholes. The richest people are always the ones who are best placed to take advantage of them. So I think it would have to be looked at really carefully. I think for the moment, the issue is, are the current levels set fair? We've got this system. Let's deal with people fairly within it, and then maybe do some research on the longer term about, you know, whether we need them.
Simon, I saw you nodding away during that.
I think the current system is a colossal mess. I think that the lifetime allowance is a particularly bad element of it. It was brought in 2006, 2007 at £1.5 million. It did actually then go up, okay, under a Labour government. Bear that in mind when everybody says, oh, it's just the Tories. They just bung money to rich people. They cut taxes for the rich. They never help the poor. So it was introduced by a Labour government. It went up to 1.8. And then under the Tories, it has come down from 1.8 to a million. And then it went up a little bit because they said they were going to start raising it in line with inflation or whatever they raise it in line with. And now they're talking about cutting it again. It's a terrible thing because it includes the growth that you get in your pension. But it's sneaky because most people think £1 million, I'll never get there. But actually more people than you realise will get to £1 million. And the people that it really damages is not the people still lucky enough to get final salary or career average or other defined benefit pensions. It's people with defined contribution pensions who are having to take all of the investment risk on themselves. And it makes no sense, as Tanya said, to have that in place at the same time as you have an annual limit on what you can put in your pension. If you've got an annual limit on what you can put into your pension and still get tax relief, you don't need the lifetime allowance. My argument would be keep the annual limit because that's a more sensible thing, but remove the taper for higher earners above £150,000 who get to a point relatively soon after that where they can only put about 10 grand in, okay? Those people, it's still important that those people build up a pension. And also the really important thing to remember is that those people pay a lot of tax. Most of those people in that bracket who are going to need that pension are PAYE. They're not the really, really rich people on millions of pounds a year who manage to pay hardly any tax. They're on PAYE. They're paying 45% tax. By the time they get to 45% tax, they have to go through the sneaky removal of the personal allowance band where they pay 60% tax between 100,000 and 123,000. And what you want to do is, as those people earn more money and continue to earn large amounts of money, you want to make them think that paying tax is their duty and it's fair. And the worst thing you can possibly do is treat them very unfairly, which is what happens to people's pensions above £150,000. So get rid of that bit, keep the normal annual allowance, ditch the lifetime allowance, job done, and then leave it alone and just let the annual allowance rise in line with inflation. Or maybe even give it a triple lock.
Hashtag Simon for Chancellor. Okay, now we're going to talk about something else completely different. It's a pretty shocking story, actually. An undercover investigation has found that many councils are failing in their duty to provide funerals when families can't afford to pay for them. Now, people are being wrongly turned away, given duff information, and many local authorities have nothing about public health funerals on their website, don't provide contact details either. Tanya, who is this investigation by? What did they find? What is actually the current law around this?
It was a charity called Quaker Social Action who have an arm called Down to Earth, where they basically help needy people find low-cost funerals or help them navigate the council system. And they obviously thought this was worth flagging as an issue, and I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't because they were having so much trouble getting councils to sort of understand their legal obligations, which are that in the last resort, a council will hold a funeral for someone if their family can't be traced, or if their family is unwilling or unable to pay. Obviously, unable is fairly obvious. They literally cannot afford it. Unwilling is sad cases where families are estranged. If you haven't spoken to someone for 30 years and you're contacted out of the blue about their funeral, that kind of thing. That's a very sad aspect of it, but that does happen.
So what is happening instead? Are people just not having funerals, Simon?
Well, Daniel? People are, I think people are going into debt to pay for it. Or if they're planning ahead, they are perhaps buying a funeral plan to protect their relatives from having to bear the enormous cost. But as we've discovered, quite a lot of them were ripping people off, and the government is now clamping down on providers and forcing a change, which is long overdue. So what I'm gathering from this report and what they discovered when they were just cold calling councils undercover is that there's very little information available. Many are not even putting anything on their websites. If they are putting anything about it on their websites, there's no contact number. When the undercover investigator was ringing up the councils, they were having immense difficulty finding the right department. I mean, we've all had this. I had to call the council last week about a leak in the road. And I made three calls and I was put through to the wrong department three times in a row. And that was just you'd think leak in the road would be an easy thing to find the right department for, wouldn't you? Something that is a little bit more unusual, like I can't afford to pay for a funeral, I'm inquiring about a public health funeral. Mm. You can understand why people will be sent round the houses by their local council. But one of the really shocking things about this report, I thought, was the investigator really found that when he did get through to the right people, he was often given duff information. He was treated rather poorly. He was interrogated. When he said, look, I'm just making an inquiry. I don't really want to give away a lot of personal information about me and my uncle. He was calling on behalf of a deceased uncle. People were getting rude and indignant towards him, and he was telling people that he'd been recently bereaved, and there was a general lack of compassion shown to somebody. I feel as well that this is maybe the kind of treatment that people who say they can't afford things get. I mean, people are needy. They cannot afford necessarily thousands of pounds for a funeral, and when they ring up to be treated rudely when you've been bereaved must be just so upsetting. The human aspect of it seems to have been lost to some extent. There's an industry survey every year done by Sun Life, and it's well over 4,000 for a pretty basic funeral. If you have a direct cremation, which is just really a cremation with no service, then you're looking at about 1,500. Now that is still an awful lot of money to somebody who has got nothing. Absolutely. Who's got nothing in their bank account.
Or it could wipe out, say give the example where, you know, when I was in my early 20s, if that had happened to me, that would have wiped out all of my savings. So yeah, it's a real problem for people. And some people might not even be lucky enough to have that money in savings. So yeah.
But the council said in response.
I went to the local government association. They basically repeated the rules, which are, you know, the legal rules. They said that councils have been struggling the last year in dealing with inquiries because of COVID. I presume that they have shortages of staff and so on. And it also pointed out that it had worked with the government on a good practice guide for councils. Now, I want to be fair to the government and to the council. Particularly an organisation like the Local Government Association, which presumably does try to get council members to do the right thing. They have got a good practice guide. I didn't see any criticism in the Quaker Social Action Report about the good practice guide. In fact, they were using that as a yardstick and saying, you know, please fulfil your obligations in this good practice guide. So I think that the authorities, you know, in terms of the government and the body, the membership body for local authorities, have done their best to actually set up a framework where people are treated fairly. I think that for various reasons, it's falling short on the ground when people are ringing up or looking on the websites, because there's nothing on the websites often. But I don't want to blame the higher authorities necessarily.
If this has affected you, I'm sure that the team would like to hear about it, your experiences. We're going to move on now. We're going to talk about my favourite subject, house prices. We've been hearing a lot about the housing market of late. The stamp duty holiday, the race for space, increased demand, lack of supply, rising prices. As a result, the practice of gazumping has reared its ugly head again. Estate agents say the problem has never been worse than over the past few months. Now, there's calls to make it illegal, but before we get into that, is the home buying frenzy over? Signs of the property market cooling. This week, Halifax saying that house prices fell in June, but the average home is still up 9% in a year. Simon, is this a sign of things to come?
I wouldn't read too much into monthly house price figures, something that is regularly prefaced with the word volatile, as in volatile monthly house price figures. They could go back up. They could go up like 2% next month, especially on the mortgage-based surveys, which the Halifax one is. It remains to be seen. Who knows? We had the stamp duty deadline door slam shut last week, but there's still a bit of stamp duty saving to be made. The maximum saving has dramatically decreased, but the first £250,000 of a property is still tax-free. And we'll see people racing to try and get that before the end of September. There is a supply and demand imbalance going on in the market. There is a shortage of properties coming up for sale. People aren't putting their properties up for sale because they don't think they'll find somewhere else to buy. Then they accept an offer and they can't find anywhere else to buy. There's a shortage in the rental market in popular places. I mean, usually it's a sort of one or the other does really well. But in some places, like, you know, the commuter belt around London, the sales market is red hot and the rental market's red hot. So I don't know where this ends, but there's enough. I think there's enough momentum in it that it will continue on for the time being. I tell you what was incorrect was I think I might have made some kind of pronouncement back in November or December last year that I was calling the end of this mini property boom. Egg on my face. just goes to show. Don't listen to me. But I mean, it is kind of mad, but who knows? I mean, and then, as you said, gazumping is back. Yeah, that is a direct product of what we're talking about.
What is gazumping?
Gazumping. That is when somebody has agreed to buy a house. But you've got to bear in mind that in England, certainly, when somebody agrees to buy a house, that is not binding until exchange of contracts. And it takes quite a long time to get to exchange of contracts. Months, in fact. And so somebody might come in with a higher offer. And the person who is selling might say, do you know what? That person's going to pay me an extra 20 grand. I'm going to take their offer. And they might go back to the person they've already agreed to sell with and say, I'm very sorry, but we're pulling out of our deal because this person's going to pay us more. Or they might say, or, I mean, you can match it if you want, or you can pay us a little bit more than that. And some people will do because they, hey, you've committed to it. You've invested money into it, but you've also invested emotion into it. You had originally decided that that was the property for you above all the others that you could have chosen from. And now you've thought about moving in, you've spent money on it, you've become even more emotionally invested. And so you go, oh, okay, all right, we'll have to find the money from somewhere. And I know of someone who this happened to recently who was gazumped, and I think that they went back and matched the offer, and then the seller still pulled out on the day of exchange. Mm. Now, the thing about gazumping is it is considered in many circles to be extremely bad karma. If you believe what goes around comes around, then you need to be careful about this kind of stuff. But hey, if you're going to live in a house for the next 20 years, maybe you think it's worthwhile gazumping someone. Or if you need all the money you can get to move, then you think it's worth taking the money off someone. But there have been calls for this to be in some way made illegal. I'm not sure how you would make it illegal, but then I never thought they'd make leaving the house illegal. So
can't they do what they do in Scotland?
Yes, that's the more sensible thing. They want to make offers binding and bring in a system, which does exist in many countries, whereby once you make the offer, not just saying, I'll give you £250,000, that's it, you bought it, there's no pulling out of it. It's you say it, you agree it, you sign something, you do a binding document, and unless there's a very good reason for you not being able to buy, you have to buy, or if there's a very good reason not for you not being able to sell, vice versa, you have to sell. Yeah, I mean, it's
how hard would that be to implement?
Well, I don't know. Okay, so Ian McKenzie from the Guild of Property Professionals says, while the situation in Scotland is much better when it comes to gazumping, it is by no means perfect. Most agents in Scotland are also solicitors, therefore overseen by the Law Society, which considers gazumping a disciplinary offence. This means most estate agents in Scotland would have to withdraw their services if a client wished to accept a higher offer. Of course, this means that gazumping can still happen. It's just unlikely in practice. So it would require a complete change around in the system. There are a surprising number of estate agents who would back some form of threat to gazumping. You would think the estate agents would just be like, no, it's the market, let the market decide. But actually, the worst thing that can happen for an estate agent is that a sale falls through. It doesn't really matter whether a house sells for £20,000 more or not. It makes almost no difference to the fee that they get, because they get a percentage fee in most cases that's 1%, 1.5% or whatever. What really matters to them is that the sale goes through. So stuff that makes offers more binding is actually massively in estate agents' interests. And gazumping is a very unpopular thing. But you have the opposite. Gazundering.
Yeah.
Gazundering is when you agree to buy a place and you get right up to the point of exchange, the point where you're so close to the wire that you know they're going to have to say yes. And you go, I'm sorry, I can only pay you £20,000 less. That's not renegotiating, just to be clear. You know, that's not the someone saying, look, things have changed and we either need to pull out or we need to renegotiate. That's a like last minute job, day before, on the day sometimes, thing that goes on.
But we're not in that sort of property market where that would be a really likely thing to happen. That's why we're seeing more gazumping than gazundering. Is that fair?
Tis true. Tis true. Mm. In this market, you see gazumping. In the market that we had in the Brexit year, you would see gazundering.
Either way, bad karma, people. Bad karma. Finally, reader email. Let me just go through it. Your reader has just started working for the council. Now, due to her new role, she's a signatory on the council's bank account, which happens to be the bank where she is personally a customer and has been for the past 40 years. Now, as such, Nat West, the bank in question, is insisting the council's business account is linked to hers, making her security codes the only way for them to access the council's account. Now, Nat West told her that her personal and the employer's business account must be in the same place. She asks, is changing from NatWest seriously the only way I can have my personal banking separated from my employer's? Goodness, Tanya, unpack this for us, would you?
It's really hard to unpack because a lot of it is incomprehensible. I had to read the NatWest response a few times to see what they were getting at. It seems that they have a system set up so that for the customer's convenience, they can have that they keep their business and their personal accounts in the same place. And they are looking at alternatives for people with community who also have community accounts of the kind that this person has. Well, I've got two problems with that. Why haven't they got this system in place already so that people have got a choice? For the people who are running a business and want their personal and business accounts together, fine. Absolutely. For those who want it separate, have it separate. Why have they not got this option? I'd also say that for people who have a business and personal account, some of them might want to keep it really separate as well. It's not just about, this is a case where public money is involved. Yeah. You can see how serious it is. But a lot of people who run businesses, other people are involved in their businesses. They have fellow directors, they have employees. And for ethical reasons and also, you know, practical reasons, they might want to keep it separate too. So I really don't understand NatWest's position here at all. In answer to the reader's question, the conclusion was, yes, I think you do have to get another bank account, which is, well, I mean, that's the solution, isn't it? But NatWest will be losing at least one of those accounts. If I was this person, I think I'd be looking to move my personal and my business account, maybe one of them first and then the other one second, because of the situation I found myself in.
Wonder how much control she could have over changing the council's business account, but certainly she could do her own. I mean, I agree with you. I was reading this story and just think, you know, even if NatWest turned around and said, yeah, really sorry, it's a bit of a computer says no, but we've managed to do something as they normally do, I would have just gone, do you know what? I'm going to go and take my money elsewhere anyway, because just this is so inconvenient.
Yeah, it comes to something when it's more convenient to move your entire account than to run two accounts side by side. You'd think that would be the more convenient option. I will say, though, that you have to go through all these money laundering hoops now. And then, you know, you're expected to keep two accounts side by side, practically intermingled. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. The rules are so strict in one case. And it seems, well, lax to say the least in this particular case. Like I say, I don't understand it.
Yeah, no, neither do I. And finally, Simon suggested that we talk about the football, right? I mean, it's relevant. There's been lots of speculation about how much it will boost the economy. $3 billion spending during the tournament if we go all the way, and we've gone pretty much all the way, just the final hurdle to go, whichever time you're listening to this. And potentially, Simon French from Panmure Gordon said the feel-good factor afterwards could boost a $10 billion spur in spending. But Simon, I really think you want to talk about this because you went to the game on Wednesday and you want to show off. Am I right?
Yeah, of course. Yes, I did go to the game on Wednesday. I had a ticket. I was lucky enough to get one. I bought it. So the ticket thing has been quite amusing. Basically, the best way to get tickets for this, other than pay through the nose to a tout, was to have applied for tickets when Euro 2020 tickets first went on sale, which was a really long time ago. I think me and Lee were in the office talking about how what we were going to do and like how many we should apply for and like how much should we be committing to if in case we got all the tickets in some point in 2019, I think. Then obviously Euro 2020 got moved. But because we were already in the system, and I've got friends who did the same thing, it meant that when it got cancelled, then when it was put back on again, and then when people got their tickets cancelled because they reduced capacity, and then when they decided to increase capacity again and put the tickets back on sale, you got priority in terms of trying to get tickets. Now, that paid off for some of us who got semi-final tickets off the back of this because of the slightly crazy system of cancelling a load of the tickets only to announce a couple of weeks later that actually they could have more people in the stadium and then having to resell those tickets. Slightly insane way to do business, but yeah, it paid off. I got my ticket before the Germany game. So I basically paid €195 for the option of watching England if they got through to the semi-final. If they hadn't have done, I could have been paying quite a lot of money to go watch the Ukraine play Denmark. But anyway, it paid off. Wednesday night, and the atmosphere was fantastic. I've never been to a game with an atmosphere like it. I've been to a lot of big games. I've been to cup finals, been to playoff finals. I've not been to a Champions League final, been to UEFA Cup final, things like that. I've never been in a stadium where you have so many people just positively urging the team on constantly to win throughout the whole game. And it was very, very positive atmosphere kind of thing. But more to the point, with a business podcast and leading on from that kind of positive atmosphere, I think the football as a whole, not just England, has been a benefit to people because they've watched people all around Europe having a good, basically going out and having a good time. Now, obviously there are COVID concerns about that, but you know, theoretically it's COVID secure. But you know, unless you're just totally not interested in football at all, which lots of people are totally not interested in football at all, even those people who are even vaguely interested in football, there has been a feel good factor about the whole of the tournament, not just England. And it encourages people to go out and spend. They go out and they spend because they have barbecues. They get beers in. They go out to restaurants. They go out to pubs. They go buy stuff. You can't get an England shirt for love nor money. And there is actually a discernible economic benefit from your country's team doing well in a major tournament. There is one from a major tournament anyway, and especially if some of that major tournament happens in your country, as has here. But even Rishi Sunak said football-induced euphoria could translate into an economic bounce. He said the enormous amount of joy that has been prompted by England's success in reaching the final should help boost consumer confidence and could even cause output to rise, he told the Today programme yesterday. Yep. So there you go. England, ironically, could become more productive thanks to loads of people having really late nights and drinking and supporting the England team. Eventually it will become more productive. I would not suggest it would necessarily become any more productive on Monday morning,
no,
whether England win or lose. But yeah, it's a once in 55 years occasion. Those things don't come around that often. And so it's easy to see why this is considered to be a kind of economic boost. And it's an economic boost that's coming on top of an economic boost that's already coming as the economy reopens and so on. So let's hope it lasts and that the spike in COVID cases goes away.
Indeed. Let's hope it does. Let's hope England win. And let's hope Rishi Sunak is the only politician to talk about the football.
Sorry, just one note of caution. Independent economist Julian Jessop tweeted, "I'd love to say winning the Euros will boost the UK economy, or at least the English bits, but it wouldn't change any of the fundamentals."
There is some rumour that Boris Johnson might announce a bank holiday if England win.
So I hear, yes.
For those of us who don't follow the football, I can get behind that.
Excellent. There you go. Something also for everyone, except
the economic boost of a bank holiday. There's also that that's talked about, the economic boost of a public holiday, which makes you question where exactly the balance lies between just giving people more public holidays and going to work. I mean, could we get to the point where we had like half a year of bank holidays and that was giving an economic boost?
You know, I'm sure there's lots of people that would be worth giving that a go just to see how it works out. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.